Thank you to both counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement. Our next case is State versus Michael Ross. If counsel could step forward. We're going to wait here for Justice Alvin and Judge Cuff to join us before we start that argument. Let me welcome our guests who are here today and tell you that we're going to take a break after this next case, and Justice Patterson is going to have a chance to speak with you during that break. Mr. Walensky, you can relax until we get all our members. May we please have appearances of counsel?
Yes. May it please the court. Nancy Hewlett, H-U-L-E-T-T, Assistant Prosecutor for the State.
Jay Walensky from the Office of the Public Defender, representing Michael Ross.
Good morning, counsel. Ms. Hewlett, you may proceed.
May it please the court. The issue before the court today is whether the trial court abused its discretion in substituting a juror who became ill during deliberations and could not continue. The issue, as stated, is pretty straightforward and pretty simple to state, but as the old saying goes, the devil's in the details. And the answer to the issue is a very fact-specific one. And the precedent from this court holds that there are no per se rules in this circumstance when it comes to substitution of a juror. And this court has left it to the sound discretion of trial courts to decide when and if it's appropriate. The appellate division and the defendant here is asking the court for something quite different. The defendant and the appellate division want this court to say that there is a per se rule that a substitution can never occur once a jury has indicated a deadlock and the trial court has instructed it to continue deliberations. And as the state has outlined in its briefs to the court, there is no support in this court's precedent for such a per se rule. Trial court here, after considering all the circumstances that he had before him, decided that substitution was appropriate. The defendant did not object to it. The reconstituted jury deliberated over the course of 4 days, took new notes, asked for readback, deliberated fairly, and came to a verdict. The defendant received all the process that he was entitled to when it comes to a fair and impartial deliberation. And that's my opening statement. What happened here was unfortunate in the sense that a juror who was deliberating along with her other peers became ill. The trial court undertook to make sure that the juror was really ill, that this wasn't a situation where you have a holdout juror, that she somehow was reacting to bad blood, disagreements in the jury deliberation room. He was sensitive to it. He spoke to the juror in the courtroom after the juror indicated that she was sick. He spoke to her personally in the presence of counsel the next day, made a comment on the record that she really did seem to be sick, and decided that in a double homicide case involving a lot of evidence, that the jury could continue deliberations with one of the alternates. And so he substituted the juror. And it now seems that the defense is arguing for this rule that because the jury had indicated a deadlock, that substitution could not occur. And the state submits that when the jury indicated its deadlock, it hadn't indicated an impossible or an intractable deadlock. And it was never objected to by defendant when the impasse note came, which I don't really call an impasse note per se, because when the jury sent that note, it said, we have been unable to reach a unanimous verdict. What is your next instruction? So the jury was telling the judge, we haven't been able to reach an agreement up to this point. What do you want us to do? So I don't like to call that note an impasse note.
It was a note. They said, what the note said was the jury was unable to reach a unanimous decision on any count. What is your next instruction? I mean, that I think barely can be read to say, are we done? Can we go home? Are we going to have pizza before we leave, or are we out of here? I mean, isn't that...
Well, I agree with Your Honor that the jury was asking for guidance, because the jurors aren't lawyers. They don't know if it meant they had deliberated for enough time that they could go home, or maybe they were asking the judge, well, do we have to stay? Do we have to continue? The note in and of itself does not indicate a hopeless deadlock, such that the trial court had no other option at that point in time but to declare a mistrial. And that's what this court said in State v. Zacker. You look at all the circumstances, a totality of circumstances, to decide whether or not you're going to tell a jury who indicates an impasse whether or not they should continue.
Is it the state's position that if we decide that the trial court made the correct decision and gave the Zacor charge to allow the jury to continue deliberating, then it was entirely, if that decision is insulated from any further review because it was reasonable, valid, based on valid reasons, and the trial court's judgment, does that insulate then the judge's determination as to whether or not to replace the ill juror at a later point in time? Or do you think the two issues can converge and be assessed together?
No, my position is it's insulated, because at the point in time that the judge acted, he had before him a note from the jury indicating that they had been unable to reach a unanimous verdict. What is your next instruction? So at that point in time, the judge had to decide, as this court ruled in Zacker, would further deliberations be reasonable? Would it be reasonable to expect the jury to reach a verdict? So that takes into account the nature of the case, the kind of evidence you have. And in this case, involving multiple charges, two counts of homicide, over 100 pieces of evidence, and a lot of witnesses to go over, the judge in his discretion decided that I'm going to tell the jury that they have to continue deliberating. And that was an appropriate decision on the facts of this case.
That's an entirely separate issue, is it not, from the substitution of the juror?
Yes, it is. Now, and that's why I answered that it really is a separate consideration what happened after that. Because what happened after that, over an hour later, when the jury went back, and they did continue deliberating, they came back with the note saying, juror number 5 is sick, she won't be returning tomorrow. It's not as though the jury came back with another note and said, we're not getting anywhere, we're not progressing. The juror became sick. Because the note indicating that the juror was ill came about an hour or so after the impasse asking for further instruction note, the judge had to make sure that the juror here was really sick, that there really was something personal to her as opposed to her being a holdout, because a judge can't substitute a holdout juror. So the judge did everything that he was supposed to do. He spoke to the juror in open court, decided to let the jurors go for the day, called the juror back the next morning, spoke to her personally, determined that she really was sick and could not continue. So he assured himself and counsel that this really was a juror who had a personal reason for not being able to continue. And then at that point, the issue was not whether is the jury deadlocked, because we know that they weren't. The issue is, had the deliberations progressed to such a point that they could not engage in meaningful deliberations with an alternate? And again, some of the concerns that obtained with the reissuance of a Zacker charge obtained here as well. What is the nature of the case? Is it complex? Is it simple? Have they reasonably deliberated proportionate to the case? And the answer to that question is no, they hadn't. There was no indicia that a substitution could not lead to meaningful deliberations with a new jury and starting fresh.
What's our foundational or our root thoughts for asking those questions as far as substitution?
Well, it's defendant's right to a fair trial, basically, and
so
his right to...
It's a process.
Yes.
We want to assure the integrity of the process.
That is correct.
So when the judge makes the determination that it's appropriate to replace the infirm juror and allow the jury to continue, does it make any sense for a reviewing court to consider at all what happened thereafter? does it matter how many hours or days that the newly constituted jury deliberated before it reached its conclusions? Should the assessment of the judge's performance end at the time he has decided to seat the alternate?
I submit, Your Honor, that the court can look to what happened. And the court did the very same thing in State v. Williams, where it was dealing with substitution of a juror who had financial hardship. This court noted in its opinion that after the substitution in that case, the jury deliberated for 3 hours. I believe it was a drug distribution case. And the court noted that, I guess it's empirical evidence as it was, that the reconstituted jury had deliberated for 3 hours, which was evidence that they had deliberated. So in this case, there is no prohibition to considering what happened with the reconstituted jury, because it shows that they were deliberating.
Williams wasn't really focused on that. Williams was really focused on the length of time the jury was deliberating before the financial hardship came to the attention of the court and the juror was asked to be excused. So I know in that opinion, the opinion's author did mention how much the jury deliberated thereafter, but wasn't really the focus on what happened before.
Well, I believe, Your Honor, if I recall that section of the opinion, when the court outlined how many hours the reconstituted jury had deliberated, it was noting that fact to show support for the fact that it had deliberated, mm-hmm. that the process had been fair. Because the whole focus on substitution is whether new deliberations with a newly constituted jury are going to be meaningful, whether there is going to be the exchange between the 12 jurors. So in this case, the state doesn't see any problem with the court taking into account what actually happened after the juror was dismissed and the alternate was sworn and the jury deliberated. And there is empirical evidence to show that they did deliberate, that they followed the trial court's instructions.
So would your position be different if they had only deliberated for a half hour after the substitution?
Yes. That's exactly what happened in Jenkins, where a juror substitution was taken, and then 23 minutes later, the jury came back with a verdict. So the case would be of a very different posture.
In Jenkins also, the trial judge and the attorneys had reason to know what the vote count was.
Yes, Your Honor. If my understanding of the opinion is, that came out almost through serendipity through the trial court's voir dire of the problematic juror. And as I was saying earlier, how it's discretionary with the trial court, there's a very fine balance because the trial judges are not supposed to be getting into the deliberative process. They're not supposed to ask questions that get into, well, where do you stand on this? And how did you come down on this? It's a very, very fine line to draw. So what the trial court has to do is balance what objective criteria he has. What kind of case are you dealing with? What does the jury tell you in its note? What kind of language does it use? What kind of feel do you have from the jurors? Something that the trial court's in a unique position to have. And also the comments and positions of counsel, which here were all, everybody was in agreement. The court and counsel were all in agreement as to how these notes should be handled. And now, of course, defendant is taking a different position. But the trial court did not abuse its discretion. And the court can certainly look to what happened with the reconstituted jury.
How does looking to the post-substitution course of deliberations help the trial judge and the attorneys? For the attorneys, first of all, to fashion their position on whether there should be substitution, and for the trial judge to decide whether there should be substitution. They don't know what's going to happen
how
does that help them? That we're trying to give a guidance to the court and to counsel as to how to address this situation. How does post-substitution course of deliberations help that inquiry?
It doesn't help the inquiry that Your Honor is talking about. Where it helps is on appeal, where a reviewing court is looking at the record and determining whether there was an abuse of discretion.
But we really shouldn't be encouraging appeals, should we?
No.
No.
But sometimes issues arise, as they always do. And if the argument is, I did not have a fair and impartial jury, there was no reasonable basis for deliberation, and you have evidence in the record that shows that the jury deliberated, it's very hard to ask a judge, an appellate court, to ignore it. So the state's argument was made in relevance to the appeal. But at the time that the judge made his decision, as I said earlier, you look at whatever objective criteria you have. You have the nature of the case, you have, which includes the evidence, the charges, you have the positions of counsel, you have...
Let's talk about the position of counsel. Shouldn't a great deal of weight be placed upon their positions? Because it's going to be a certain amount of speculation, particularly where there's a deadlocked jury, you know, whether or not that point of closed minds has arrived. So to what degree should defense counsel be bound by his request that the case go forward?
Well, the state submits he should be bound, and if he tries to challenge that decision on appeal, he's held to plain error, which is a much higher standard. So here, the attorneys who were there in the courtroom along with Judge Mulvihill, who saw the jurors, who had a feel for the case at the time all of this was happening, did not believe that the jury was hopelessly deadlocked, had no objection to the jury being told continue. And then when the unfortunate circumstance arose with juror number 5 becoming sick, had no objection to holding off for 24 hours, having her call the next day, and then having her be substituted. It's very important. They had no problem with this at the time of trial.
To a certain degree, and this may apply to the state as well as the defense, when you substitute a juror, it's a crapshoot. You're not certain where it's going to go.
I would agree with that, Your Honor. We don't know where the jury was at, and that's precisely why the answer to your question has to be yes, because nobody knows exactly where the jury was. And as I mentioned earlier, the trial courts have a very delicate balance here. The law holds we're not supposed to inquire about what goes on in their deliberation room. So we're really not supposed to ask them, well, where are you? Sometimes you know by just serendipity, as I said before.
But even if in determining whether or not someone is a holdout, that's an inquiry into what's...
That is correct.
And so there is an element in this entire process of intruding into the private deliberations of that jury.
Yes, I agree, Your Honor, but it's a it has to be done carefully.
But we said in Jenkins, under no circumstances should the trial court elicit what the breakdown is.
I agree, Your Honor, yes, and that's why I said the judges... Trial courts are in a delicate situation. Sometimes, as I said, it comes out by sheer luck, but you're not supposed to ask that. So the appellate division in this case engaged in what the state submits was rank speculation to hold, as it did, that when the juror sent out the impasse note, they had intractable positions. Well, if that were the case, and if the circumstances of the case supported that, then Judge Mulvihill would have had to have declared a mistrial. He wouldn't have been permitted under Zacher to tell them to continue deliberating. But that wasn't the case here.
And nobody disputes that.
No one disputes that. The appellate division took as a given that this juror was dismissed for personal reasons. So nobody disputes that she was dismissed for personal reasons. But at the time that the judge was acting here, he had to make sure that she wasn't a holdout and was just using an illness as perhaps an excuse to get off. And he also had to decide whether a substitution at that point would still allow the reconstituted jury to engage in reasonable deliberation. So the nature of the case, the charges, his feel for the jury as much as the arguments of counsel. And
well, he stated as one of his reasons was that he had the sense that the jury wanted to continue to deliberate because of the enthusiasm, if you will, or willingness with which they discarded their old notes and began everything fresh with new pads and
yes,
so forth.
Yes, that is true. Yes, indeed. So I submit, Your Honor, it's a totality of the circumstances. And if there's any argument made at a later point that somehow the trial court abuses discretion, a reviewing court can certainly look to what actually happened to corroborate or inform the decision on whether this was an appropriate ruling. And the jury here, jury number two, deliberated. It clearly deliberated. There was no intractable deadlock here that prevented a substitution, did not deny defendant his right to a fair and impartial jury deliberation. And as I said in my opening, there should be no per se rules. It's just not supported in this court's precedent. There's no reason for the court to abandon that precedent. The trial courts are perfectly capable of making these decisions. And as I said in my opening, they're fact-specific, so no two cases are going to be alike.
Haven't we, though, while saying that there are no per se rules, haven't we already indicated that if there's evidence of bias by one of the jurors, then that substitution's not appropriate?
All right.
We have to assume
taint. I'm sorry, I misspoke. There is one rule, you cannot dismiss a holdout juror. I mean, that's very clear, so I misspoke. But other than that one example, there are no per se rules that I can glean from the precedent from the court.
Well, even a holdout, there may be circumstances if the holdout is for inappropriate reasons. Jenkins is an example of that.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But even in those circumstances, it may be permissible.
Yes. And if I understand Jenkins, the court did make that if a juror is not following the law, is not fulfilling his or her duty, that would be a basis for dismissal. The difficulty in the Jenkins case was that during the colloquy with the problematic juror, it became known what the vote was, 11-1. So she was a holdout. So, again, that was a time where the substitution would not have allowed for meaningful deliberations because the jury had two camps, 11 for guilt, and then this one problematic juror who just was not going to vote guilty. So, again, no per se rule. Every case is different. So there's just no basis for the appellate division to hold that once the jury has indicated a deadlock, that you can't subsequently substitute for with an alternate.
Is there anything you'd like to add, Ms. Hewlett?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Walensky.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I believe that I can be brief in my prepared remarks because the appellate division in this case got it right. And the appellate division got it right by following its own precedent in Banks, which was the natural extension of Jenkins, which was the natural extension of Corsaro. The appellate division here and in Banks as well just had to draw on well-established principles to hold that it was impermissible to substitute for an ill juror after the jury had sent out a note that it was, and I emphasize the word was, past tense, unable to reach a verdict. Your Honors, the key principle, I think, was stated in Jenkins, that the focus is on the process. The focus is upon having 12 fully deliberating jurors. And the phrase mutuality of deliberations comes through all of the case law. And the issue that you have in a case like this, particularly after the jury has deliberated over the course of 4 days before the substitution, is first of all, whether the jury can truly begin to deliberate anew, whether or not it intends to by getting new pads, but whether it can deliberate anew, and second of all, whether the new jury can truly become a fully functioning member of that jury. And the appellate division followed well-established principles in holding no, and that's what we have here. And in the prepared remarks, Your Honors, I would also like to speak briefly to the plain error issue. The applicable standard is right here in the case law pertinent to this issue. Corsaro says whether the error has a clear capacity for an unjust result, and when the issue is the integrity of jury deliberations, even if the error is committed by defense counsel in good faith, you have reversible error. That standard was met here. It's inherent in the facts of the deliberation, and the appellate division decision should be affirmed. I would be pleased to answer any questions which the court may have.
In the face of the note that yes. you summarized for us, was it incumbent on the judge to declare a mistrial?
It was not incumbent to declare a mistrial, no. We have Zatcher. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. And implicit or inherent in Zatcher is, yes, you can send a jury back. But I think what you have here is a recognition that once a jury has sent out a note, particularly a note that definitive, and the word that they used was, I think what we're talking about is a much higher hurdle for the jury to accept a new juror and for the new juror to become a fully functioning member of that jury.
If the breakdown were 6-6, and therefore the jury is basically nowhere, it's evenly divided, why wouldn't this jury, after the Chakor charge, which you say is appropriate, not be able to reconstitute itself and engage in the type of mutuality of discussions that is spoken of in Corsaro and Jenkins?
Because, Your Honor, the original jurors have deliberated from the beginning, and they have deliberated to a point where they are satisfied that their opinions cannot
change. Well, that can't
change.
Be the case, because if Chakor means anything, and you're saying it's appropriate, it means that every juror has to revisit his and her opinions, okay, towards reaching a unanimous verdict. Because if they're not willing to do that, there's no purpose to the charge. And if they're willing to do that, engage in that type of mutuality of discussion, why wouldn't you be able to introduce a new juror, particularly where the defense attorney is urging that it be done?
Your Honor, the question is first of all, the answer is first of all, that what the case law does is it recognizes that there is an additional hurdle, and it talks about the process. It talks about an additional impediment to a new juror joining that process once the initial jurors have said, we have made up our minds. Can we send them back? Yes, we send them back.
No, they said we've reached an impasse.
Yes.
You've conceded that Chakor was an appropriate charge, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Underpinning Chakor is the ability of the jurors, to revisit the opinions that they may tentatively have reached, and to change them after engaging in discussions with their fellow jurors, correct?
Your Honor, they are told to. But the question is introducing a new juror into mix.
What evidence is there that the new juror changed the composition? You've indicated that it was appropriate to send the jury back for more deliberation. That it was fine. They hadn't come to a complete impasse, or otherwise the structure wouldn't have been appropriate. Now you put in a totally separate issue, which is a juror becomes ill, and you suddenly change your position, say they couldn't decide it. They had already come to an impasse. Isn't that flying in the face of your earlier admission that a Chakor charge was appropriate?
No, Your Honor, it doesn't, because my argument, and I think the recognition in the case law, is that inserting a new juror changes the equation. That you have the original jury that's deliberated from the start. And question number one is, can this jury truly deliberate anew, not just re-examine positions, their positions that they have, can they deliberate anew, and can this juror be a part of those deliberations?
It's easy for you to say now, after the client has been convicted, but the trial counsel, okay, who is making the decision at the time, obviously believed that he had a shot with that jury and with the substitution, and was willing to go forward. And if we accept your argument, it's the classic two bites of the apple.
You know, let me throw the dice and see whether or not I can get an acquittal with this reconstituted jury. And if it doesn't work out for me, I can always count on the Supreme Court to bail me out.
Your Honor, very respectfully, I could not disagree more. And the reason that I could not disagree more is that, very frankly, something that the state brought up in his in the argument of the state was that counsel said, I don't know that I could formulate an argument against it. And the reason is that neither counsel nor the prosecutor nor the court knew the binding precedent in Banks.
Banks isn't binding to us. Let's look at Jenkins.
It's not binding to the Supreme Court. It would have been binding on that
okay,
court.
Okay, but Jenkins certainly has a whole lot more weight with us. In Jenkins, the defense attorney was arguing vehemently against the substitution. That's number one.
Yes.
Number two, in Jenkins, they knew the vote count because the departing juror had said, there were 11 people against me. So those are facts. And plus, the jury deliberated for a short while.
Yes.
None of those factors are present here. And this reconstituted jury deliberated longer than the first jury in this case.
It did deliberate for a long time. But I think the appellate division...
17 hours. That's a real long time.
Okay. I think the appellate division addressed that in saying that that simply could have been the amount of time that it took for one original camp to make the other original camp.
That's entirely...
Your Honor, if I may...
Speculation.
Your Honor, if I may, I think that everything here is speculation. And that's a reason, I believe, as Justice Cuff alluded to, for a rule that can be followed by trial judges, as we have in Corsaro.
Mr. In this case, we have to take things a step at a time. The first step, and you have conceded, was whether or not the judge should send the jury back to continue deliberations on the Sasher. You have conceded that that decision by the judge was not erroneous. Am I correct in reading?
That's correct. I don't think that one could ever object to an initial Zachor charge the first time that a jury says that it has an impasse.
And then there is a substantial period of time when the jury is deliberating, about an hour or so. And then a brand new problem results. A juror indicates that he or she is sick. At that point, the judge has to make a determination whether or not it is a legitimate claim of sickness or
yes.
whether or not the juror simply wants out because
yes.
that juror is a holdout juror. And in this case, the judge conducted an inquiry of the juror, became satisfied that she was truly sick. Why is there an intractable rule that once they've announced that they are deadlocked and they nevertheless accept the judge's instructions to continue deliberating, there can be no substitution? A juror can die and that mistrial has to be declared?
Because, Your Honor, I think it goes back to the holding in Corsaro. It goes back to the rationale of the California Supreme Court in State versus Collins that was cited extensively by this court, that once the jurors' opinions have hardened enough that they're willing to send out a note to the court that says the jury was unable to reach a verdict, then it's past the point where a new juror can fully...
So that they are willing to reconsider their positions if the group membership does not change. That's your point. But if the membership is changed by one person, that creates an intractable problem with respect to the integrity of the deliberations.
Your Honor, I think the question is not willing but can. The question is not willing but able. And I believe that the implication of all of the case law that we have is that particularly given that one never knows, perhaps in Jenkins by a freak circumstance, but normally one never knows what's going on in the jury room, this is what the courts have said. They have said that this is a practically a sacred process, mutuality of deliberations, and if the original jury has said we're hardened to a point where...
Yes. There's a difference between jurors reaching some temporary or initial point. And the other situation where the jury has passed the point of no return, where the jury has hardened to the position to find the defendant guilty, and the substituted juror has no way of altering that balance. That's not clear here to be the case.
Your Honor, I think that the answer to that, and it's something that I struggled with in the case, but I think it lies in the distinction between the jury as a whole and the 12 jurors. And the question here is whether the other 11th are going to let the new one in, whether the new one is going to be able to come in. And what the appellate division found here, I think rightly, is that it's too late once those positions have hardened. And I think that the question here really deals with the jury.
But we know that they hadn't hardened for the group that decided to change their votes to convict the defendant.
Ultimately.
It may very well have, it could have been under different circumstances that the shift could have been in your client's favor. And then you wouldn't be here today.
That is on the one hand true, and on the other hand, maybe the trial court would have made the wrong decision. This is a place where, again, I think Justice Cuff was absolutely right. This is a place where trial courts need guidance. And what the state is offering is only a post hoc evaluation.
Mr. Walensky, we also deal with the rule of that a jury will, we presume, they follow the instructions that they have been given.
Yes.
And they have been given an instruction. We want you to go back. We want each of you to examine your position, be open-minded, as far and continue your deliberations. Doesn't your position ignore that presumption?
Your Honor, I believe that the Corsaro opinion talks explicitly about situations in which following that presumption is not reasonable and exceptional rules are required, and that this is a situation that requires them. And that's why when the state talks about asking for new pads, taking notes down off of the wall, that's great. That's wonderful. It signals an intent to deliberate anew, but it says nothing about ability to deliberate anew. And I think that that's the distinction. And I think that that distinction is very apparent in the case law.
The argument you're advancing would be clearer, perhaps stronger, if the first note had come out and said, we've been unable to reach a verdict. Our minds are closed. Would you agree?
Your Honor, I think, yes, that would not have been a natural note for a juror to send. I think the use of the word was, and it wasn't are not, were not, the word was. The jury was unable. They think they're done. So
why wasn't a mistrial required then?
Because of Zatra. The first time you send him back. The first time you send them back, but I think what we have in the case law is a distinction.
We don't have a rule that says that.
If they had sent a note similar to the one that I used in the hypothetical, would the Zatra charge have been appropriate?
Perhaps I shouldn't commit myself so quickly.
We won't hold you to it.
Okay. Thank you. I do appreciate that. But there's a distinction. I mean, there is a distinction. They sent out a note that says we are unable, or we were not able. And they're pretty solid at that point. They are pretty solid at that point.
So then the rule should be they get the charge once in that setting, but if anything else happens, no matter what?
I think it would be at the very least difficult to not give the charge once if we're not talking about dragging into weeks. If I dug myself into a hole by making the rule more stringent, I do apologize. I would think that usually you're going to get a Zatcher charge in the first instance, but that doesn't mean that the jury dynamic issue that undergirds all of this is not implicated when a jury comes back with a note that says the jury was unable.
Is the length of time that the jury has deliberated before indicating a deadlock relevant?
I think it's extremely relevant. And I think that intuitively you may look to the amount of time after the substitution, but in fact the case law recognizes that the amount of time before is amount of time that jurors have for their opinions to harden. I think the time before is very appropriate and very relevant. And
are there other relevant factors, say how many counts there might be, how long the trial it took, how many witnesses?
Those things could be relevant, but past an initial point, you really have the flow of the case.
What is that initial point?
You have the story of the case, and I think the way it's going to go.
What is that initial point that you speak of?
I don't think
it's
definable.
How long? Is there a bright line? 2 hours? 20 minutes? 3 days?
I would not suggest that it's not related to the length of the case. I don't think there's any way that you could definitively
state it. It depends upon a lot of things, the complexity of the case, the
yes.
length of the trial. And shouldn't a great deal of weight be placed on the opinions of trial counsel, both defense counsel and the prosecutor? If both believe that a substitution is appropriate, don't you think that the trial judge should give those opinions great weight?
I'll give a conditional yes to that, Your Honor. I'll give a conditional yes in the sense that in this case, I don't believe we had defense counsel urging that result. I think we had defense counsel not realizing that there was law upon which he could base an objection.
But how do we know that? We don't have any.
Your Honor, actually, we do. What we have is defense counsel, in making the motion for a new trial, essentially falling on his sword and saying, I didn't know about this law. And had I known about it, and the judge didn't know about the law, and the prosecutor didn't know about the law. So he had the basis for an objection. He just
there's
didn't
nothing
know
in,
it.
The, in the contemporaneous statement of the lawyer that would suggest, well, look, I'm troubled by this, but I don't think I have basis to object. Later he's making a motion and making an argument, but
I believe that during the colloquy, the lawyer said, I don't think I have any basis to object. I believe that that was in the contemporaneous colloquy.
Well, yeah, well, he said, I don't think there's any credible way to even form an objection. If I had one, and he didn't have one. Because he started out by saying, I have no objection, Judge, to the substitution.
Ready? After you finish this answer, is
only that if I can take that one step further and perhaps draw a difference between acquiescing and urging. I thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement. Court's going to take a brief